The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hey, my dudes, and welcome to the Feminist Book Club podcast, the show that brings you the best of the best feminist content. I'm your host, Neba from Notes by Neba, and today we're going to talk about colorism, from then to now. We'll be getting into the history of colorism, how it crops up in modern places like Bridgerton and the royal family, as well as skin lightening products. This episode includes a trigger warning for rape, discrimination, and body image. If any of these topics are difficult for you, please proceed carefully, because your mental health comes first.
Today's episode is sponsored by us, Feminist Book Club, and specifically our Women's History Month flash sales. Every month is Women's History Month, but we're doing something extra special in March. We've marked down some of our most popular books and are practically giving them away. Upcoming titles in our sale include Kindred by Octavia Butler, Fat Activism by Charlotte Cooper, and Me and White Supremacy by Layla F. Saad. Keep an eye on our Instagram for new flash sales. Shop now at feministbookclub.com. Shipping is free in the United States and all sales are final.
Colorism is the discrimination against people with darker skin. It comes not just from white supremacy and colonialism, but also from internalized white supremacy. So colorism can occur across races and also within the same race. The effects include the likelihood of being hired, someone's, quote, desirability, unquote, and skin lightening products, all of which cost Black and brown communities our health, our money, and our mental health. We're in a world that should be moving beyond that. Let's start off with the show that's become the biggest ever series ever on Netflix, Bridgerton, a romance set in the Regency era. With its luscious look, outrageously hot leads, and color-inclusive casting, the show has just skyrocketed in popularity. But it's not as progressive on race as it seems, and you can see the clear reason why. Colorism. Lighter-skinned Black characters on the show mostly hold powers of positions of nobility, like the regal Queen Charlotte and Simon, the Duke of Hastings. Darker-skinned Black characters are just pushed to the sidelines and appear villainous or violent, like Simon's father, who cruelly banished his son due to his stutter. I really liked what some Twitter users had to say about it. Twitter user @pronouncedJenny, "The colorism so far in Bridgerton is blinding. That is all I can focus on with each passing scene. I'm on episode 2, and I've already lost sight of the story, because most of the main Black characters are really light, and the darker characters are maids or doormen. The absolute beep." it's so important to see the dangers in colorism and the way that colorism reinforces the same old notion that says lighter is better. Another Twitter user @AzaleaDunn echoed that sentiment. Like other folks have pointed out, the colorism is a problem. Dark-skinned background actors and light-skinned leads. A choice was made, and it's not a good look. None of this means that Bridgerton should be canceled, per se, but could the show have had a larger cultural impact if it took the next step and allowed darker characters to be more than background scenery and to be part of the main primary actors in the series? If they wanted to have a cast that was more diverse in terms of color hue, they could have easily done so. There's a number of dark-skinned, extremely talented actors and actresses. But ultimately, the show's colorism hinders meaningful inclusion for the melanin community. Also, just a few days ago, Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, told Oprah Winfrey that a member of the royal family raised the issue of how dark their unborn baby's skin would be. Their unborn baby. Meghan has a Black father, a Black mother, excuse me, and a white father, so she's been subject to a whole storm of racist harassment from tabloids. And as even unborn children are judged for their skin color, let's backtrack a few steps. First of all, where did this term colorism even come from? To give y'all some background, the term colorism was first coined in 1983 by Pulitzer Prize winner Alice Walker in her classic womanist text, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, where she defines it to mean the prejudicial or preferential treatment of same-race people based solely on their color. All the books and research and articles that are mentioned in this episode will be included in the description. So, colorism isn't quite racism, although there is a clear relationship. An example of racism would be, say, a bakery that refuses to sell to Native people. Colorism, on the other hand, might be a hiring manager that prefers to hire lighter-skinned Indian people rather than darker-skinned Indian people. A key point here is that colorism can occur across races, but also within the same race. Before Alice Walker created this term, Black Americans used words like color-struck or color-phobia. This is incredibly significant because this attempt to define this phenomenon came from Black womanist theory, which makes sense since its effect is keenly felt by Black women. There's ties to perceived attractiveness, femininity, desirability, and sexuality. And we'll get more into all of this in a second because there's a lot to unpack there. Here in the US, people from all over the world have immigrated to come here, or were enslaved to come here, or have been oppressed by being here first. So the colorism here in the US is both homegrown and imported. For example, slavery in America was inherited. So whether or not you were considered a slave depended on your mother. This meant that when white male slave owners had children, aka raped black slaves, those children were also slaves and contributed to their father's wealth, and yet were not quite the same level of children as with their white partners. But under this system, if a person had a white father and a black mother, or more importantly, they looked white, then that person might have more potential claim to freedom with that lighter skin. But Black Americans are not the only people obsessed with how light or dark a person's skin is. This is a global societal ill felt in many places all around the world, including Latin America, Southeast Asia, the Caribbean, and Africa. I myself am South Asian. I'm of Indian heritage, to be specific. The color discrimination in India may be attributed to the colonial period, when white British people ruled over Indians, a colonial period that ended only about 75 years ago. But colorism in India may be even stronger than that, tracing back to the ancient caste system that's still alive even today. The caste system divides people into groups based on their work. For centuries, people from lower caste did manual labor outdoors, like farming or disposing of dead animals or any other task that was deemed too, quote, unclean, unquote, for the higher castes. All these long hours of work under the sun meant tanning and getting darker skin. So this caste system became a lot more distinct when British colonizers entered the picture, though. So ultimately, now, many Indians have internalized all those prejudices. So darker-skinned Indians face discrimination, like at work, at school, and colorism is also very gendered. So darker-skinned Indian women face these additional barriers in work and school and just pretty much all over their life. So now today, we have outlawed slavery in the US, and segregation is supposedly a thing of the past. But I wanted to know more about modern colorism, so I went deeper into today's colorism research. And what did I find? I found study after study after study showing how skin tone affects power, privilege, and success. These factors regularly determine who gets hired, who gets convicted, and who gets elected. All the studies and topics mentioned in this episode have been linked in this description. Firstly, darker-skinned people report higher experiences of microaggressions. There's even difference in pay rates between darker-skinned and lighter-skinned black men. This is eerily similar to the differences in pay between whites and blacks. Darker-skinned black women are given longer prison sentences, they report more physiological deterioration, and they self-report worse health than lighter-skinned women. And colorism begins early, real early. If you are a dark-skinned girl, you are 3 times more likely to be suspended from school than your light-skinned peers. Even worse, well, maybe not even worse, but still worse, colorism affects how we are remembered by other people. Interviewers remember educated black people with lighter skin, regardless of how light or dark their skin might be. And I want to add here that there's an importance in distinguishing between colorism as practiced by white power structures, like judicial courts or the police or big corporations, versus the colorism as practiced within black and brown communities, like when we talk about marriage statistics and measurements of color. In theory, if white people disappeared from the planet tomorrow, colorism might still exist in our communities, which is a very painful thing to wonder about. Talking about colorism from white power structures is much, much easier to do than internal colorism, and I think that this is because of internalized white supremacy, something most people are reluctant to acknowledge because it can be so painful, and unlearning is a difficult thing to do. All of this, you know, ultimately affects our mental health, our well-being, and because colorism influences who and what people perceive as beautiful, it has a tendency to affect women a lot more than men. To understand colorism, we also have to understand the perception of beauty. Different groups and communities and places in the world will define it differently, because whether you say you're light-skinned or dark-skinned is relative to your social context and what community you live in. It's really messed up to think that color factors into who a community deems to be worthy of romance. A lot of the research that I was looking at ultimately factored people into women or men, and unfortunately was not much information about non-binary, trans, gender non-conforming, etc. type people. I hope that eventually research will cover them, but more than that, I really hope that colorism just ultimately disappears off the face of the earth. But of the research I did find, sure enough, it showed that dark-skinned women are less likely to be married than lighter-skinned women. There were some Indian marriage websites that let users filter out matches based on their skin tone. In the recent Netflix show, Indian Matchmaking, there are frequent and casual mentions that marriage candidates should be, quote, fair, quote. And when they say fair, really what they mean is have light skin. And it's crazy how often they mention this and just how casually. It's just casually dropped in. Oh, we want someone who is really fair and nice and kind. Like they say it as just part of a regular sentence. And just with all of this like racism and colonialism and white supremacy and colorism, enter skin lightening products. These products represent a massive industry. In the US, the market alone is an estimated $2.3 billion. And when you look at the global scale, the estimated market value as of 2020 is $8.6 billion. So most of these types of products, these skin lightening or whitening products, they mostly come in cream form, but some other treatments I found also included pills, and there were even some intravenous formulas, aka like injections. So in addition to the negative impact on mental health, there's also the physical health aspect. There's legal and illegal skin lightening products, and many of them have hazardous chemicals like hydroquinone, mercury, steroids, and sometimes even bleach. These substances can all lead to discoloration, damaged skin, kidney damage, and more. And while there are some protections in this industry and some regulations, the market has also just been filled with counterfeit or low-quality products that have had really high concentrations of these chemicals. In India, for example, about half of all the skincare products, including creams, serums, different things, half of all of them are lighteners that will, quote, brighten or, quote, lift, which is just market speak, really, for whitening. Some of them even come with like little shade cards, kind of like paint swatches, so that way the people who use them can track how light their skin becomes. The most popular brand of skin lightener is Fair and Lovely, made by the business giant Unilever. And Unilever is a massive corporation. They make food, they make tea, toothpaste, healthcare products, beauty products. I digress, but one ad for Fair and Lovely suggested to use it before you go to a job interview. There was a series of ads that showed a woman losing her lover because she was too dark and then, quote, like winning, unquote, the lover back after she lightened her skin using the product. Since Fair and Lovely is so huge, generations of Indians have grown up seeing ads and shelves just lined with Fair and Lovely and other skin lightening and whitening products. I will say, you know, some products claim to work by using multivitamins like vitamin B3. And while that may be great, you know, giving your skin vitamins, nourishing it, etc., there's not really a fast, easy, cheap way of telling what exactly is in the product. And not to mention, there's also a lot of other skincare products out there that are healthy for your skin that I recommend. You know, vitamin C is a really great way of trying to get that glow. I highly recommend using that early in the morning, right before you go under the sun. Another thing is sunscreen, sunscreen, sunscreen. Constantly said in the skincare community, suncare is a really important part of any regime. But ultimately, even though you might not be able to control how other people perceive you, you can control how you perceive your own beauty and worth. Skincare is important, but I think the move is to try and aim for your health rather than conforming to a specific beauty standard. So, what can you do? Well, One, don't go looking for skin lightening creams. That part should be fairly straightforward after talking about all these health issues. But also, if you're concerned about your own dark spots, using the word hyperpigmentation or saying dark spots, not saying, oh, I really don't like how dark I am. There's a very clear difference in kind of that mental shift and also how you phrase those things. Words have power, as we all know here on the Feminist Book Club podcast. There's also been like some good news. There's been a ton of progress on this issue. There's been a lot of darker skinned models landing larger, more visible and very large campaigns. There's also been unfair and lovely slogans all over the place trying to celebrate, you know, people who are of darker skin tone or have, quote, dusky skin. And, you know, especially after last year, there's also been the amplification of Black creators. But ultimately, we can and we should do more. For example, if you're into beauty, skincare, fashion, makeup, lifestyle, all that stuff, take a good hard look at who you are following and see that you are drawing inspiration from all types of beauty, not just white-skinned beauty. And that is all I have for today on the history of colorism and how it crops up in modern places. Coming up next week, we'll be talking inclusivity in fiction. And if you'd like a sneak peek at the episode, come join our Feminist Book Club Clubhouse. Feminist Book Club Clubhouse. what a mouthful. I'm going live every Wednesday at 4:15 p.m. Pacific time. And if you have a topic you'd like to discuss or a question you have for me, or you just want to drop a hi, my DMs are always open and you can find me on pretty much any platform, YouTube, Insta, Twitter, TikTok, at Notes by Neba. You can also find me on my website at notesbyneba.com. That is all I have for you guys today. Thank you so much for joining me and I will see you on the next page.
Hi everyone, Renee here. Did you miss me? I've got a quick review of a book I read recently. Today I want to tell you about War Requiem by Kaya Solvay-Preuss, published by the Essay Press in April of 2020. The title of this book comes from the title of composer Benjamin Britten's 1962 opus of the same name, commissioned by the Church of England for the consecration of the Coventry Cathedral, which was destroyed in World War II and rebuilt in 1962. This piece of music is a chaotic 90-ish minute of orchestra, choirs, soloists, and an organ. The lyrics blend the Latin Mass with nine poems about war by English poet Wilfred Owen, who was killed in combat a week before the end of the First World War. This book is a blend of memoir and standard historical nonfiction, reflecting on the author's experience singing the War Requiem with her college choir, and the biographies of both Benjamin Britten, the composer, and Wilfred Owen, the poet, and her experience writing it all together. Anyone who's ever performed with a group of musicians can relate to being overcome by a piece and borderline obsessed with it. It's clear that the experience performing this work changed the author, and the only way to get it out of her system was to completely lose herself in the history of the piece. The result is a stunning mosaic of a book featuring these men's lives, the effect of war, and a deep respect for music performance. I imagine it's particularly difficult to write about music. I'm not a writer, so I don't pretend to know much about the craft. However, Preuss does something special in this book. It's broken into sections named for each of the six movements of the composition. So I found a recording of War Requiem on YouTube, and I listened to that in the background while I read this book, which gave me just one of the most unique reading experiences I've ever had. It became clear to me that the mood of each section of the book matched the mood of each movement in the music. The book isn't very long. It moves quickly. It crescendos to a peak near the end and ends quietly but memorably, much like the music. Though I had never sang or even heard War Requiem, I did sing in my college's top choir and performed a number of huge orchestral pieces in concert halls around the country. I feel a kinship with the author on that note, as I do with any other hardcore choral music nerd. So this book scratched an itch I didn't know I had, and I'm so impressed with how well Preuss writes about the experience of singing in a choir, learning an ambitious new piece, being intimidated by a piece, just looking at the notes and thinking, I will never figure out how these go together, and then performing with a full orchestra. This book was very much up my alley, but it may not be for everyone. I would, though, suggest it for other group musicians and choir nerds in particular, as well as for veterans or anyone affected by war. The composer Benjamin Britten was a pacifist and conscientious objector to World War II. But the poet, Wilfred Owen, depicts the brutalities of war through his poetry, which is featured in both the book and the musical piece, and he literally wrote those poems in the trenches. Preuss writes all this into her book, and while ultimately the book centers two dead white dudes, in the end, it's about art and war and how those two things can collide and impact many generations. So, once again, that's The War Requiem by Kaya Solveig Preuss from Essay Press. And that is today's show. You can find me, Renee, on Instagram. I'm behind the Feminist Book Club box Instagram, or my personal account is Belle Renee. See you next time. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.